Everyone thought my lord would choose Fair Walder, Lady Walder Bolton told Sir Wendell, shouting to be heard above the music. Fat Walder was a round pink butterball of a girl with watery blue eyes, limp yellow hair, and a huge bosom. Yet her voice was a fluttering squeak. It was hard to picture her in the Dreadfort, in her pink lace and cape of bear.
My lord grandfather offered Roos his bride's weight in silver as a dowry, though, so my lord of Bolton picked me.
The girl's chins jiggled when she laughed.
I weigh 6 stone more than Fair Walder, but that was the first time I was glad of it. I'm Lady Bolton now, and my cousin's still a maid, and she'll be 19 soon, poor thing.
The Lord of the Dreadfort paid the chatter no mind, Catelyn saw. Sometimes he tasted a bite of this, spoon of that, tearing bread from the loaf with his short, strong fingers, but the meal could not distract him. Bolton had made a toast to Lord Walder's grandsons when the wedding feast began, pointedly mentioning that Walder and Walder were in the care of his bastard son. From the way the old man had squinted at him, his mouth sucking at the air, Catelyn knew he'd heard the unspoken threat. Was there ever a wedding less joyful, she wondered, until she remembered her poor Sansa and her marriage to the imp. Mother, take mercy on her. She has a gentle soul. The heat and smoke and noise were making her sick. The musicians in the gallery might be numerous and loud, but they were not especially gifted. Catelyn took another swallow of wine and allowed her page to refill her cup. A few more hours and the worst will be over. By this hour tomorrow, Rob would be off to another battle, this time with the Iron Men at Moat Cailin. Strange how that prospect seemed almost a relief. He will win his battle. He wins all his battles, and the Ironborn are without a king. Besides, Ned taught him well. The drums were pounding. Jingle Bell hopped past her once again, but the music was so loud she could scarcely hear his bells. Above the din came a sudden snarling as two dogs fell upon each other over a scrap of meat. They rolled across the floor, snapping and biting, as a howl of mirth went up. Someone doused them with a flagon of ale, and they broke apart. One limped towards the dais. Lord Walder's toothless mouth opened in a bark of laughter as the dripping wet dog shook ale and hair all over three of his grandsons. The sight of the dogs made Catelyn wish once more for Grey Wind, but Rob's direwolf was nowhere to be seen. Lord Walder had refused to allow him in the hall.
"Ye wild beast, as a taste for human flesh, I hear,
the old man had said.
"Rips out throats, yes, I'll have no such creature at my Rosalind's feast, amongst women and little ones, Oh, my sweet innocence!"
"Grey Wind is no danger to them, my lord," Rob protested. "Not so long as I am there."
"You were there at my gates, were you not, When the wolf attacked the grandsons, I sent to greet you, I heard all about it, Don't think I didn't,
No harm was done.
"No harm, the king says, no harm, Petaya fell from his horse, fell. I lost a wife the same way, falling."
His mouth worked in and out.
"Oh, was she just some strumpet, Bastard Walder's mother, yes, now I recall. She fell off her horse and cracked her head, What would your grace do if Petaya had broken his neck, Give me another apology. In place of a grandson. No. Might be you're a king. I won't say you're not. The king in the north, But under my roof, my rule, Have your wolf, or have your wedding, sire. You'll not have both,
Catelyn could tell that her son was furious, but he yielded with as much courtesy as he could summon. "If it pleases Lord Walder to serve me stewed crow smothered in maggots," he told her, "I'll eat it and ask for a second bowl." And so he had. The Great John had drunk another of Lord Walder's brood under the table, Pataya Pimple this time. The laird has a third his capacity. What did he expect? Lord Umber wiped his mouth, stood, and began to sing, "A bear there was, a bear, all black and brown and covered with hair." His voice was not at all bad, though somewhat thick from drink. Unfortunately, the fiddlers and drummers and flautists up above were playing Flowers of Spring, which suited the words of the bear and the maiden fair, as well as snails might suit a bowl of porridge. Even poor Jingle Bell covered his ears at the cacophony. Roose Bolton murmured some words too soft to hear, and went off in search of a privy. The cramped hall was in a constant uproar of guests and servants coming and going. A second feast for knights and lords of somewhat lesser rank was roaring along in the other castle she knew. Lord Walder had exiled his base-born children and their offspring to that side of the river, so that Rob's northmen had taken to referring to it as the Bastard Feast. Some guests were no doubt stealing off to see if the bastards were having a better time than they were. Some might even be venturing as far as the camps. The Freys had provided wagons of wine, ale, and mead, so the common soldiers could drink to the wedding of River Run and the twins. Rob sat down in Bolton's vacant place. "A few more hours and this farce is done, mother," he said in a low voice, as the great John sang of the maid with honey in her hair. "Black Walder's been mild as a lamb for once, and Uncle Edmure seems well content in his bride." He leaned across her. "Sir Ryman?" Sir Ryman Frey blinked and said, "Sire? Yes?" "I'd hoped to ask Olivar to squire for me when we march north," said Rob. "But I do not see him here. Would he be at the other feast?"
"Olivar?" Sir Ryman shook his head. "No, not Olivar. Gone. Gone from the castles. Duty."
"I see." Rob's tone suggested otherwise. When Sir Ryman offered nothing more, the king got to his feet again. "Would you care for a dance, mother?" "Thank you, but no." A dance was the last thing she needed, the way her head was throbbing. "No doubt one of Lord Walder's daughters would be pleased to partner you." "Oh, no doubt." His smile was resigned. The musicians were playing Iron Lances by then, while the great John sang The Lusty Lad. Someone should acquaint them with each other. It might improve the harmony. Catelyn turned back to Sir Ryman. "I had heard that one of your cousins was a singer."
"Erisander, Simon's son. Eric's is his sister."
He raised a cup towards where she danced with Robin Flint. "Will Alessander be playing for us tonight?" Sir Ryman squinted at her.
"Not him. He's away."
He wiped sweat from his brow and lurched to his feet.
"Pardons, my lady, pardons."
Catelyn watched him stagger toward the door. Edmure was kissing Rosalind and squeezing her hand. Elsewhere in the hall, Sir Mark Piper and Sir Danmore Frey played a drinking game. Lame Lothar said something amusing to Sir Hustin. One of the younger Freys juggled three daggers for a group of giggly girls, and Jingle Bell sat on the floor sucking wine off his fingers. The servers were bringing out huge silver platters piled high with cuts of juicy pink lamb, the most appetizing dish they'd seen all evening. And Rob was leading Daisy Mormont in a dance. When she wore a dress in place of a hauberk, Lady Major's eldest daughter was quite pretty, tall and willowy, with a shy smile that made her long face light up. It was pleasant to see that she could be as graceful on the dance floor as in the training yard. Catelyn wondered if Lady Mage had reached the neck as yet. She had taken her other daughters with her. But as one of Rob's battle companions, Daisy had chosen to remain by his side. He has Ned's gift for inspiring loyalty. Olivar Frey had been devoted to her son as well. Hadn't Rob said that Olivar wanted to remain with him even after he'd married Jane? Seated betwixt the Black Oak Towers, the Lord of the Crossing clapped his spotted hands together. The noise they made was so faint that even those on the dais scarce heard it, but Sir Aenys and Sir Huston saw and began to pound their cups on the table. Lame Lothar joined them. Then Mark Piper, and Sir Danwell, and Sir Raymond. Half the guests were soon pounding. Finally, even the mob of musicians in the gallery took note. The piping, drumming, and fiddling trailed off into quiet.
"Your Grace," Lord Walder called out to Rob, "the septon has prayed his prayers. Some words have been said, and Lord Edmure's wrapped my sweetling in a fish cloak, eh? But they're not yet man and wife. A sword needs a sheath, eh? And a wedding needs a bedding. What does my sire say? Is it meet that we should bed them?"
A score or more of Walder Frey's sons and grandsons began to bang their cups again, shouting, "To bed, to bed, to bed with them!" Rosalind had gone white. Catelyn wondered whether it was the prospect of losing her maidenhead that frightened the girl, or the bedding itself. With so many siblings, she was not like to be a stranger to the custom, but it was different when you were the one being bedded. On Catelyn's own wedding night, Jory Cassell had torn her gown in his haste to get her out of it, and drunken Desmond Grell kept apologizing for every bawdy joke, only to make another. When Lord Dustin beheld her naked, he told Ned that her breasts were enough to make him wish he'd never been weaned. Poor man, she thought. He'd ridden south with Ned, never to return. Catelyn wondered how many of the men here tonight would be dead before the year was done. Too many, I fear. Rob raised a hand. If you think the time is meet, Lord Walder, by all means let us bed them. A roar of approval greeted his pronouncement. Up in the gallery, the musicians took up their pipes and horns and fiddles again and began to play "The Queen Took Off Her Sandal and the King Took Off His Crown." Jingle Bell hopped from foot to foot, his own crown ringing.
"I hear Tully men have trout between their legs instead of cocks," Alex Frey called out boldly. "Does it take a worm to make them rise?"
To which Sir Mark Piper threw back, "I hear that Frey women have two gates in place of one." And Alex said,
"Aye, but both are closed and barred to little things like you."
A gust of laughter followed until Patrick Mallister climbed onto a table to propose a toast to Edmure's one-eyed fish.
"And a mighty pike it is," he proclaimed. "Nay, I'll wager it's a minnow,"
Fat Walder Bolton shouted out from Catelyn's side. Then the general cry of "Bed them! Bed them!" went up again. The guests swarmed the dais, the drunkest in the forefront as ever. The men and boys surrounded Rosalind and lifted her into the air, whilst the maids and mothers in the hall pulled Edmure to his feet and began tugging at his clothing. He was laughing and shouting bawdy jokes back at them, though the music was too loud for Catelyn to hear. She heard the great John, though.
"Give this little bride to me,"
he bellowed as he shoved through the other man and threw Rosalind over one shoulder.
"Look at this little thing, no meat in her at all."
Catelyn felt sorry for the girl. Most brides tried to return the banter, or at least pretended to enjoy it, but Rosalind was stiff with terror, clutching the great John as if she feared he might drop her. "She's crying too," Catelyn realized as she watched Sir Mark Piper pull off one of the bride's shoes. "I hope Edmure is gentle with the poor child." Jolly, bawdy music still poured down from the gallery. The queen was taking off her kirtle now, and the king his tunic. She knew she should join the throng of women round her brother, but she would only ruin their fun. The last thing she felt just now was bawdy. Edmure would forgive her absence, she did not doubt. Much jollier to be stripped and bedded by a score of lusty, laughing Freys than by a sour, stricken sister. As man and maid were carried from the hall, a trail of clothing behind them, Catelyn saw that Rob had also remained. Walder Frey was prickly enough to see some insult to his daughter in that. "He should join in Rosalind's bedding, but is it my place to tell him so?" She tensed until she saw that others had stayed as well. Petiah Pimple and Sir Wayland Frey slept on, their heads on the table. Merritt Frey poured himself another cup of wine, while Jingle Bell wandered about stealing bites off the plates of those who'd left. Sir Wendell Manderley was lustily attacking a leg of lamb, and of course Lord Walder was far too feeble to leave his seat without help. He will expect Rob to go, though. She could almost hear the old man asking why his grace did not want to see his daughter naked. The drums were pounding again, pounding and pounding and pounding. Daisy Mormont, who seemed to be the only woman left in the hall besides Catelyn, stepped up beside Edwin Frey and touched him lightly on the arm as she said something in his ear. Edwin wrenched away from her with unseemly violence.
"No," he said too loudly. "I'm done with dancing for the nonce."
Daisy paled and turned away. Catelyn got slowly to her feet. What just happened there? Doubt gripped her heart, where an instant before there had only been weariness. "It is nothing," she tried to tell herself. "You are seeing gremlins in the woodpile. You are becoming an old, silly woman, sick with grief and fear." But something must have shown in her face. Even Sir Wendell Manderley took note.
"Is something amiss?"
he asked, the leg of lamb in his hands. She did not answer him. Instead, she went after Edwin Frey. The players in the gallery had finally gotten both king and queen down to their name-day suits. With scarcely a moment's respite, they began to play a very different sort of song. No one sang the words, but Catelyn knew the reins of Castamere when she heard it. Edwin was hurrying toward a door. She hurried faster, driven by the music. 6 quick strides, and she caught him. "And who are you?" the proud lord said, "that I must bow so low?" She grabbed Edwin by the arm to turn him, and went cold all over when she felt the iron rings beneath his silken sleeve. Catelyn slapped him so hard she broke his lip. "Oliver," she thought, "and Perwin, Alessandra, all absent." And Roslyn wept. Edwin Frey shoved her aside. The music drowned all other sound, echoing off the walls as if the stones themselves were playing. Rob gave Edwin an angry look and moved to block his way, and staggered suddenly, as a quarrel sprouted from his side just below the shoulder. If he'd screamed then, the sound was swallowed by the pipes and horns and fiddles. Catelyn saw a second bolt pierce his leg, saw him fall. Up in the gallery, half the musicians had crossbows in their hands instead of drums or lutes. She ran toward her son until something punched her in the small of her back, and the hard stone floor came up to slap her. "Rob!" she screamed. She saw Small John Umber wrestle a table off his trestles. Crossbow bolts thudded into the wood. 1, 2, 3, as he flung it down on top of his king. Robin Flint was ringed by Freys, their daggers rising and falling. Sir Wendell Manderley rose ponderously to his feet, holding his leg of lamb. A quarrel went in his open mouth and came out the back of his neck. Sir Wendell crashed forward, knocking the table off its trestles, and sending cups, flagons, trenchers, platters, turnips, beets, and wine bouncing, spilling, and sliding across the floor. Catelyn's back was on fire. "I have to reach him." The small John bludgeoned Sir Raymond Frey across the face with a leg of mutton, but when he reached for his sword belt, a crossbow bolt drove him down to his knees. In a coat of gold, or a coat of red, a lion still has claws. She saw Lucas Blackwood cut down by Sir Hustin Frey. One of the Vances was hamstrung by Black Walder as he was wrestling with Sir Harry's Haig. "And mine are long and sharp, my lord, as long and sharp as yours." The crossbows took Donald Locke, Owen Norrie, and half a dozen more. Young Sir Benfrey had seized Daisy Mormont by the arm, but Catelyn saw her grab up a flagon of wine with her other hand and smash it full in his face, and run for the door. It flew open before she reached it. Sir Ryman Frey pushed into the hall, clad in steel from helm to heel. A dozen Frey men-at-arms packed the door behind him. They were armed with heavy long axes.
"Mercy!"
Catelyn cried, but horns and drums and the clash of steel smothered her plea. Sir Ryman buried the head of his axe in Dacey's stomach. By then men were pouring in the other doors as well, mailed men in shaggy fur cloaks with steel in their hands, Northmen. She took them for a rescue, for half a heartbeat, till one of them struck the small John's head off with two huge blows of his axe. Hope blew out like a candle in a storm. In the midst of slaughter, the Lord of the Crossing sat on his carved oaken throne, watching greedily. There was a dagger on the floor a few feet away. Perhaps it had skidded there when the small John knocked the table off its trestles, or perhaps it had fallen from the hand of some dying man. Catelyn crawled toward it. Her limbs were leaden, and the taste of blood was in her mouth. "I will kill Walder Frey," she told herself. Jinglebell was closer to the knife, hiding under a table, but he only cringed away as she snatched up the blade. "I will kill the old man. I can do that much at least." Then the tabletop that the small John had flung over Rob shifted, and her son struggled to his knees. He had an arrow in his side, a second in his leg, a third through his chest. Lord Walder raised a hand, and the music stopped. All but one drum. Catelyn heard the crash of distant battle, and closer, the wild howling of a wolf. "Grey Wind," she remembered too late.
"Hey!" Lord Walder cackled at Rob. "The king in the north arises. Seems we killed some of your men, your grace. Oh, but I'll make you an apology. That will mend them all again, eh?"
Catelyn grabbed a handful of Jinglebell Frey's long grey hair and dragged him out of his hiding place. "Lord Walder," she shouted, "Lord Walder." The drum beat slow and sonorous. Doom, boom, doom. "Enough," said Catelyn. "Enough, I say. You have repaid betrayal with betrayal. Let it end." When she pressed the dagger to Jinglebell's throat, the memory of Bran's sick room came back to her with a feel of steel at her own throat. The drum went boom, doom, boom, doom, boom, doom. "Please," she said, "he is my son, my first son and my last. Let him go, let him go, and I swear we will forget this, forget all you've done here. I swear it by all the old gods and you. We will take no vengeance." Lord Walder peered at her in mistrust.
"Only a fool would believe such blather, eh? You take me for a fool, my lady, eh?"
"I take you for a father. Keep me for a hostage. Edmure as well, if you haven't killed him, but let Rob go."
"No." Rob's voice was whisper faint. "Mother, no."
"Yes, Rob, get up. Get up and walk out. Please, please, save yourself. If not for me, for Jane."
"Jane?"
Rob grabbed at the edge of the table and forced himself to stand.
"Mother," he said, "Grey Wind."
"Go to him. Now, Rob, walk out of here." Lord Walder snorted.
"And why would I let him do that, eh?"
She pressed the blade deeper into Jinglebell's throat. The Lackwit rolled his eyes at her in mute appeal. A foul stench assailed her nose, but she paid it no more mind than she did the sullen, ceaseless pounding of that drum. Boom, doom, boom, doom, boom, doom. Sir Ryman and Black Walder were circling round her back, but Catelyn did not care. They could do as they wished with her, imprison her, rape her, kill her, it made no matter. She had lived too long, and Ned was waiting. It was Rob she feared for. "On my honour as a Tully," she told Lord Walder, "on my honour as a Stark, I will trade your boy's life for Rob's, a son for a son." Her hand shook so badly she was wringing Jinglebell's head. "Boom," the drum sounded. "Boom, doom, boom, doom." The old man's lips went in and out. The knife trembled in Catelyn's hand, slippery with sweat.
"A son for a son, eh?" he repeated. "Well, that's a grandson, ha ha! And he was never much use."
A man in dark armour and a pale pink cloak, spotted with blood, stepped up to Rob. "Jaime Lannister sends his regards." He thrust his longsword through her son's heart and twisted. Rob had broken his word, but Catelyn kept hers. She tugged hard on Aegon's hair and sawed at his neck until the blade grated on bone. Blood ran hot over her fingers. His little bells were ringing, 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 and the drum went boom, doom, boom. Finally someone took the knife away from her. The tears burned like vinegar as they ran down her cheeks. 10 fierce ravens were raking her face with sharp talons and tearing off strips of flesh, leaving deep furrows that ran red with blood. She could taste it on her lips. "It hurt so much," she thought. "Our children, Ned. All our sweet babes. Rickon, Bran, Arya, Sansa, Rob. Rob, please, Ned, please, make it stop. Make it stop hurting." The white tears and the red ones ran together until her face was torn and tattered, the face that Ned had loved. Catelyn Stark raised her hands and watched the blood run down her long fingers, over her wrists, beneath the sleeves of her gown. Slow red worms crawled along her arms and under her clothes. It tickles. That made her laugh, until she screamed.
"Mad!" someone said. "She's lost her wits!"
And someone else said, "Make an end!" And a hand grabbed her scalp, just as she'd done with Jingle Bell, and she thought,
"No, don't. Don't cut my hair. Ned loves my hair."
Then the steel was at her throat, and its bite was red and cold. Arya. The feast tents were behind them now. They squished over wet clay and torn grass, out of the light and back into the gloom. Ahead loomed the castle gatehouse. She could see torches moving on the walls, their flames dancing and blowing in the wind. The light shone dully against the wet mail and helms. More torches were moving on the dark stone bridge that joined the twins, a column of them streaming from the west bank to the east.
"The castle's not closed,"
Arya said suddenly. The sergeant had said it would be, but he was wrong. The portcullis was being drawn upward, even as she watched, and the drawbridge had already been lowered to span the swollen moat. She had been afraid that Lord Frey's guardsmen would refuse to let them in. For half a heartbeat she chewed her lip, too anxious to smile. The hound reined up so suddenly that she almost fell off the wain.
7 bloody buggernels!"
Arya heard him curse, as their left wheel began to sink in soft mud. The wain tilted slowly.
"Get down!"
Clegane roared at her, slamming the heel of his hand into her shoulder to knock her sideways. She landed light, the way Syria had taught her, and bounced up at once with a face full of mud.
"Why did you do that?"
she screamed. The hound had leapt down as well. He tore the seat off the front of the wain and reached in for the sword belt he'd hidden beneath it. It was only then that she heard the riders pouring out of the castle gate in a river of steel and fire, the thunder of their destriers crossing the drawbridge almost lost beneath the drumming from the castles. Men and mounts wore plate armor, and 1 in every 10 carried a torch. The rest had axes, long axes with spiked heads, and heavy, bone-crushing, armor-smashing blades. Somewhere far off she heard a wolf howling. It wasn't very loud compared to the camp noise and the music and the low, ominous growl of the river running wild, but she heard it all the same. Only maybe it wasn't her ears that heard it. The sound shivered through Arya like a knife, sharp with rage and grief. More and more riders were emerging from the castle, a column 4 wide with no end to it, knights and squires, and free riders, torches and long axes. And there was noise coming from behind as well. When Arya looked around, she saw that there were only 2 of the huge feast tents where once there had been 3. The one in the middle had collapsed. For a moment she did not understand what she was seeing. Then the flames went licking up from the fallen tent, and now the other 2 were collapsing. Heavy oilcloth settling down on the men beneath. A flight of fire arrows streaked through the air. The 2nd tent took fire, and then the 3rd. The screams grew so loud she could hear words through the music. Dark shapes moving in front of the flames, the steel of their armor shining orange from afar. A battle, Arya knew. It's a battle, and the riders. She had no more time to watch the tents then. With the river overflowing its banks, the dark, swirling waters at the end of the drawbridge reached as high as a horse's belly. But the riders splashed through them all the same, spurred on by the music. For once the same song was coming from both castles. I know this song, Arya realized suddenly. Tom O'Sevens had sung it for them. That rainy night, the outlaws had sheltered in the brewhouse with the brothers. And who are you, the proud lord said, that I must bow so low? The Frey riders were struggling through mud and reeds, but some of them had seen the wane. She watched as three riders left the main column, pounding through the shallows. Only a cat of a different coat. That's all the truth I know. Clegane cut Stranger loose with a single slash of his sword and leapt onto his back. The courser knew what was wanted of him. He pricked up his ears and wheeled toward the charging destriers. In a coat of gold or a coat of red, a lion still has claws, and mine are long and sharp, my lord, as long and sharp as yours. Arya had prayed 100 times for the hound to die, but now there was a rock in her hand, slimy with mud, and she didn't even remember picking it up. Who do I throw it at? She jumped at the clash of metal as Clegane turned aside the first long axe. While he engaged with the first man, the second circled behind him and aimed a blow for the small of his back. Stranger was wheeling, so the hound took only a glancing blow, enough to rip a great gash in his baggy peasant's blouse and expose the mail below. He's one against three. Arya still clutched her ruck. They're sure to kill him. She thought of Micah, the butcher's boy, who had been her friend so briefly. Then she saw the third rider coming her way. Arya moved behind the wain. Fear cuts deeper than swords. She could hear drums and war horns and pipes, stallions trumpeting, the shriek of steel on steel, but all the sound seemed so far away. There was only the oncoming horseman and the long axe in his hand. He wore a surcoat over his armor, and she saw the two towers that marked him for a Frey. She did not understand. Her uncle was marrying Lord Frey's daughter. The Freys were her brother's friends. Don't! She screamed as he rode around the wain. But he paid no mind. When he charged, Arya threw the rock, the way she'd once thrown a crab apple at Gendry. She'd gotten Gendry right between the eyes, but this time her aim was off, and the stone caromed sideways off his temple. It was enough to break his charge, but no more. She retreated, darting across the muddy ground on the balls of her feet, putting the wain between them once more. The knight followed at a trot, only darkness behind his eye-slit. She hadn't even dented his helm. They went round once, twice, a third time. The knight cursed her. "You can't run for—" The axe head caught him square in the back of the head, crashing through his helm and the skull beneath, and sending him flying face first from his saddle. Behind him was the hound, still mounted on Stranger. "How did you get an axe?" she almost asked, before she saw. One of the other Freys was trapped beneath the dying horse, drowning in a foot of water. The third man was sprawled on his back, unmoving. He hadn't worn a gorget, and a foot of broken sword jutted from beneath his chin. "Get me my helm!" Clegane growled at her. It was stuffed at the bottom of a sack of dried apples, in the back of the wain, behind the pickled pig's feet. Arya upended the sack and tossed it to him. He snatched it one-handed from the air and lowered it over his head, and where the man had sat, only a steel dog remained, snarling at the fires. "My brother!" "Dead!" he shouted back at her. "Do you think they'd slaughter his men and leave him alive?" He turned his head back toward the camp. "Look! Look, damn you!" The camp had become a battlefield. No, a butcher's den. The flames from the feasting tents reached halfway up the sky. Some of the barracks tents were burning too, and 50 silk pavilions. Everywhere swords were singing. And now the rains, we bore his hall, with not a soul to hear. She saw two knights ride down a running man. A wooden barrel came crashing onto one of the burning tents and burst apart, and the flames leapt twice as high. A catapult, she knew. The castle was flinging oil or pitch or something. "Come with me!" Sandor Clegane reached down a hand. "We have to get away from here, and now." Stranger tossed his head impatiently, his nostrils flaring at the scent of blood. The song was done. There was only one solitary drum, its slow, monotonous beats echoing across the river like the pounding of some monstrous heart. The black sky wept, the river grumbled, men cursed and died. Arya had mud in her teeth, and her face was wet.
"Rain? It's only rain. That's all it is."
"We're here!"
she shouted. Her voice sounded thin and scared, a little girl's voice.
"Rob's just in the castle, and my mother. The gate's even open."
There were no more Freys riding out.
"I came so far."
"We have to go get my mother."
"Stupid little bitch."
Fires glinted off the snout of his helm and made the steel teeth shine.
"You go in there. You won't come out. Maybe Frey will let you kiss your mother's corpse. Maybe we can save her.
Maybe you can. I'm not done living yet."
He rode toward her, crowding her back toward the wain.
"Stay or go, she-wolf. Live or die. You're..."
Arya spun away from him and darted for the gate. The portcullis was coming down, but slowly.
"I have to run faster."
The mud slowed her, though, and then the water.
"Run as fast as a wolf."
The drawbridge had begun to lift, the water running off it in a sheet, the mud falling in heavy clots.
"Faster!"
She heard loud splashing and looked back to see Stranger pounding after her, sending up gouts of water with every stride. She saw the long axe too, still wet with blood and brains. And Arya ran. Not for her brother now, not even for her mother, but for herself. She ran faster than she had ever run before, her head down and her feet churning up the river. She ran from him as Micah must have run. His axe took her in the back of the head. Tyrion. They supped alone, as they did so often.
"The peas are overcooked," his wife ventured once.
"No matter," he said, "so is the mutton."
It was a jest, but Sansa took it for criticism.
"I'm sorry, my lord."
"Why? Some cook should be sorry, not you. The peas are not your province, Sansa."
I am sorry that my lord husband is displeased."
"Any displeasure I'm feeling has naught to do with peas. I have Joffrey and my sister to displease me, and my lord father, and 300 bloody Dornishmen."
He had settled Prince Oberyn and his lords in a corner fort facing the city, as far from the Tyrells as he could put them, without evicting them from the Red Keep entirely. It was not nearly far enough. Already there had been a brawl in a flea-bottomed potshop that left one Tyrell man-at-arms dead, and two of Lord Gargalen scalded, and an ugly confrontation in the yard, when Mace Tyrell's wizened little mother called Ilaria Sand the Serpent's Whore. Every time he chanced to see Oberyn Martell, the prince asked when the justice would be served. Overcooked peas were the least of Tyrion's troubles, but he saw no point in burdening his young wife with any of that. Sansa had enough griefs of her own.
"The peas suffice," he told her curtly. "They are green and round. What more can one expect of peas? Here, I'll have another serving, if it please my lady."
He beckoned, and Podrick Payne spooned so many peas onto his plate that Tyrion lost sight of his mutton.
"That was stupid," he told himself. "Now I have to eat them all, or she'll be sorry all over again."
The supper ended in a strained silence, as so many of their suppers did. Afterward, as Pod was removing the cups and platters, Sansa asked Tyrion for leave to visit the Godswood.
"As you wish."
He had become accustomed to his wife's nightly devotions. She prayed at the royal sept as well, and often lit candles to mother, maid, and crone. Tyrion found all this piety excessive, if truth be told, but in her place he might want the help of the gods as well.
"I confess I know little of the old gods," he said, trying to be pleasant. "Perhaps some day you might enlighten me.
I could even accompany you.
No, Sansa said at once. You are kind to offer, but there are no devotions, my lord. No priests or songs or candles, only trees and silent prayer. You would be bored.
No doubt you're right. She knows me better than I thought. Though the sound of rustling leaves might be a pleasant change from some septon droning on about the seven aspects of grace.
Tyrion waved her off.
I won't intrude. Dress warmly, my lady. The wind is brisk out there.
He was tempted to ask what she prayed for, but Sansa was so dutiful she might actually tell him, and he didn't think he wanted to know. He went back to work after she'd left, trying to track some golden dragons through the labyrinth of Littlefinger's ledgers. But Tyr Baelish had not believed in letting gold sit about and grow dusty, that was for certain. But the more Tyrion tried to make sense of his accounts, the more his head hurt. It was all very well to talk of breeding dragons instead of locking them up in the treasury, but some of these ventures smell worse than weak old fish.
I wouldn't have been so quick to let Joffrey fling the antler men over the walls, if I'd known how many of the bloody bastards had taken loans from the crown.
He would have to send Bronn to find their heirs, but he feared that would prove as fruitful as trying to squeeze silver from a silverfish. When the summons from his lord father arrived, it was the first time Tyrion could ever recall being pleased to see Sir Boris Blunt. He closed the ledgers gratefully, blew out the oil lamp, tied a cloak around his shoulders, and waddled across the castle to the Tower of the Hand. The wind was brisk, just as he'd warned Sansa, and there was a smell of rain in the air. Perhaps when Lord Tywin was done with him, he should go to the Guard's Wood and fetch her home before she got soaked. But all that went straight out of his head when he entered the Hand Solar to find Cersei, Sir Kevin, and Grand Maester Pycelle gathered about Lord Tywin and the King. Joffrey was almost bouncing, and Cersei was savouring a smug little smile, though Lord Tywin looked as grim as ever.
I wonder if he could smile even if he wanted to.
"What's happened?" Tyrion asked. His father offered him a roll of parchment. Someone had flattened it, but it still wanted to curl. "Rosalind caught a fine fat trout," the message read. "Her brothers gave her a pair of wolf pelts for her wedding." Tyrion turned it over to inspect the broken seal. The wax was silvery-grey, and pressed into it were the twin towers of House Frey. "Does the Lord of the Crossing imagine he's being poetic, or is this meant to confound us?" Tyrion snorted. "The trout would be Edmure Tully. The pelts—"
"He's dead!"
Joffrey sounded so proud and happy you might have thought he'd skin Robb Stark himself.
"First Greyjoy, and now Stark,"
Tyrion thought of his child wife praying in the Guard's Wood even now, praying to her father's gods to bring her brother victory, and keep her mother safe, no doubt. The old guards paid no more heed to prayer than the new ones, it would seem. Perhaps he should take comfort in that.
"Kings are falling like leaves this autumn," he said. "It would seem our little war is winning itself."
"Wars do not win themselves, Tyrion," Cersei said with poisonous sweetness. "Our lord father won this war."
"Nothing is won, so long as we have enemies in the field," Lord Tywin warned them.
"The River Lords are no fools," the Queen argued. "Without the Northmen, they cannot hope to stand against the combined power of Highgarden, Castle Rock, and Dorne. Surely they will choose submission rather than destruction."
"Most," agreed Lord Tywin. "River Ron remains, but so long as Walder Frey holds Edmure Tully hostage, the Blackfish dare not mount a threat. Jason Mallister and Tyrus Blackwood will fight on for honour's sake, but the Freys can keep the Mallisters penned up at Seaguard, and with the right inducement, Jonas Bracken can be persuaded to change his allegiance and attack the Blackwoods. In the end, they will bend the knee, yes. I mean to offer generous terms. Any castle that yields to us will be spared. Save one." "Harrenhal," said Tyrion, who knew his sire. "The realm is best rid of these brave companions. I have commanded Sir Gregor to put the castle to the sword."
Gregor Clegane. It appeared as if his lord father meant to mine the mountain for every last nugget of ore before turning him over to Dornish justice. The brave companions would end as heads on spikes, and Littlefinger would stroll into Harrenhal without so much as a spot of blood on those fine clothes of his. He wondered if Pataia Baelish had reached the Vale yet. If the guards are good, he ran into a storm at sea and sank. But when had the guards ever been especially good?
"They should all be put to the sword," Joffrey declared suddenly. "The Malisters and Blackwoods and Brackens, all of them. They're traitors. I want them killed, Grandfather. I won't have any generous terms."
The king turned to Grand Maester Bycelle.
"And I want Rob Stark's head, too. Write to Lord Frey and tell him. The king commands. I'm going to have it served to Sansa at my wedding feast."
"Sire," Sir Kevin said in a shocked voice, "the lady is now your aunt by marriage."
"A jest," Cersei smiled. "Joff did not mean it." "Yes, I did," Joffrey insisted. "He was a traitor, and I want his stupid head. I'm going to make Sansa kiss it."
"No,"
Tyrion's voice was hoarse. "Sansa is no longer yours to torment. Understand that, monster?" Joffrey sneered.
"You're the monster, uncle."
"Am I?" Tyrion cocked his head. "Perhaps you should speak more softly to me, then. Monsters are dangerous beasts, and just now kings seem to be dying like flies."
"I could have your tongue out for saying that," the boy king said, reddening. "I'm the king."
Cersei put a protective hand on her son's shoulder. "Let the dwarf make all the threats he likes, Joff. I want my lord father and my uncle to see what he is." Lord Tywin ignored that. It was Joff he addressed.
"Aerys also felt the need to remind men that he was king, and he was passing fond of ripping tongues out as well. You could ask Sir Ilyen Payne about that, though you'll get no reply."
"Sir Ilyen never dared provoke Aerys the way your imp provokes Joff," said Cersei. "You heard him. Monster, he said, to the king's grace, and he threatened him."
"Be quiet, Cersei. Joffrey, when your enemies defy you, you must serve them steel and fire. When they go to their knees, however, you must help them back to their feet. Elsewise, no man will ever bend the knee to you. And any man who must say, 'I am the king,' is no true king at all. Aerys never understood that, but you will. When I've won your war for you, we will restore the king's peace and the king's justice. The only head that need concern you is Margaery Tyrell's maidenhead."
Joffrey had that sullen, sulky look he got. Cersei had him firmly by the shoulder, but perhaps she should have had him by the throat. The boy surprised them all. Instead of scuttling safely back under his rock, Joffrey drew himself up defiantly and said,
"You talk about Aerys, Grandfather, but you were scared of him."
"Oh my, hasn't this gotten interesting?"
Tyrion thought. Lord Tywin studied his grandchild in silence, gold flecks shining in his pale green eyes.
"Joffrey, apologize to your grandfather," said Cersei.
He wrenched free of her.
"Why should I? Everyone knows it's true. My father won all the battles. He killed Prince Rhaegar and took the crown, while your father was hiding under Castle Rock."
The boy gave his grandfather a defiant look.
"A strong king acts boldly. He doesn't just talk."
"Thank you for that wisdom, Your Grace," Lord Tywin said, with a courtesy so cold it was like to freeze their ears off. "Sir Kevin, I can see the king is tired. Please see him safely back to his bedchamber. Pycelle, perhaps some gentle potion to help his grace sleep restfully."
"Dream wine, my lord?"
"I don't want any dream wine," Joffrey insisted.
Lord Tywin would have paid more heed to a mouse squeaking in the corner.
"A dream wine will serve. Cersei, Tyrion, remain."
Sir Kevin took Joffrey firmly by the arm and marched him out of the door, where two of the King's Guard were waiting. Grand Maester Pycelle scurried after them as fast as his shaky old legs could take him. Tyrion remained where he was. "Father, I'm sorry," Cersei said when the door was shut. "Joff has always been willful. I did warn you."
"There is a long league's worth of difference between willful and stupid. A strong king acts boldly. Who told him that?"
"Not me, I promise you," said Cersei. "Most like it was something he heard Robert say."
"The part about you hiding under Castle Rock does sound like Robert."
Tyrion didn't want Lord Tywin forgetting that bit.
"Yes, I recall now," Cersei said. "Robert often told Joff that a king must be bold."
"And what were you telling him, pray?" "I did not fight a war to seat Robert II on the Iron Throne. You gave me to understand the boy cared nothing for his father."
"Why would he? Robert ignored him. He would have beat him if I'd allowed it. That brute you made me marry once hit the boy so hard he knocked out two of his baby teeth over some mischief with a cat. I told him I'd kill him in his sleep if he ever did it again. And he never did. But sometimes he would say things."
"It appears things needed to be said."
Lord Tywin waved two fingers at her, a brusque dismissal.
"Go!"
She went, seething.
"Not Robert II, Tyrion said. Aerys III.
"The boy is 13. There is time yet."
Lord Tywin paced to the window. That was unlike him. He was more upset than he wished to show.
"He requires a sharp lesson."
Tyrion had gotten his own sharp lesson at 13. He felt almost sorry for his nephew. On the other hand, no one deserved it more.
"Enough of Joffrey," he said. "Wars are worn with quills and ravens. Wasn't that what you said? I must congratulate you. How long have you and Waldo Frey been plotting this?"
"I mislike that word," Lord Tywin said stiffly.
"And I mislike being left in the dark."
"There was no reason to tell you. You had no part in this."
"Was Cersei told?" Tyrion demanded to know.
"No one was told, save those who had a part to play, and they were only told as much as they needed to know. You ought to know that there is no other way to keep a secret, here especially. My object was to rid us of a dangerous enemy as cheaply as I could, not to indulge your curiosity or make your sister feel important."
He closed the shutters, frowning.
"You have a certain cunning, Tyrion, but the plain truth is you talk too much. That loose tongue of yours will be your undoing."
"You should have let Joff tear it out," suggested Tyrion.
"You would do well not to tempt me," Lord Tywin said. "I'll hear no more of it. I have been considering how best to appease Oberyn Martell and his entourage."
"Oh, is this something I'm allowed to know, or should I leave so you can discuss it with yourself?"
His father ignored the sally.
"Prince Oberon's presence here is unfortunate. His brother is a cautious man, a reasoned man, subtle, deliberate, even indolent to a degree. He is a man who weighs the consequences of every word and every action. But Oberon has always been half mad."
"Is it true he tried to raise Dawn for Viserys?"
"No one speaks of it, but yes. Ravens flew, and riders rode. With what secret messages I never knew. John Arryn sailed to Sonspear to return Prince Lewin's bones, sat down with Prince Doran, and ended all the talk of war. But Robert never went to Dawn thereafter, and Prince Oberyn seldom left it."
"Well, he's here now, with half the nobility of Dawn in his tail, and he grows more impatient every day," said Tyrion. "Perhaps I should show him the brothels of King's Landing. That might distract him. A tool for every task, isn't that how it works? My tool is yours, father.
Never let it be said that House Lannister blew its trumpets and I did not respond. Lord Tywin's mouth tightened.
Very droll. Shall I have them sew you a suit of motley and a little hat with bells on it?
If I wear it, do I have leave to say anything I want about His Grace King Joffrey?
Lord Tywin seated himself again and said, I was made to suffer my father's follies. I will not suffer yours. Enough.
Very well, as you ask so pleasantly. The Red Viper is not going to be pleasant, I fear. Nor will he content himself with Sir Gregor's head alone.
All the more reason not to give it to him.
Not to... Tyrion was shocked. I thought we were agreed that the woods were full of beasts.
Lesser beasts.
Lord Tywin's fingers laced together under his chin.
Sir Gregor has served us well. No other knight in the realm inspires such terror in our enemies.
Oberon knows that Gregor was the one who...
He knows nothing. He has heard tales, stable gossip, and kitchen calumnies. He has no crumb of proof. Sir Gregor is certainly not about to confess to him. I mean to keep him well away for so long as the Dornishmen are in King's Landing.
And when Oberon demands the justice he's come for?
I will tell him that Sir Aemry Lorch killed Elia and her children, Lord Tywin said calmly. So will you, if he asks.
Sir Aemry Lorch is dead, Tyrion said flatly.
Precisely. Vargo Hoat had Sir Aemry torn apart by a bear after the fall of Harrenhal. That ought to be sufficiently grisly to appease even Oberon Martell.
You may call that justice.
It is justice. It was Sir Aemry who brought me the girl's body, if you must know. He found her hiding under her father's bed, as if she believed Rhaegar could still protect her. Princess Elia and the babe were in the nursery a floor below.
Well, it's a tale, and Sir Aemry is not like to deny it. What will you tell Oberon when he asks who gave Lorch his orders?
Sir Aemry acted on his own in the hope of winning favour from the new king. Robert's hatred for Rhaegar was scarcely a secret.
It might serve, Tyrion had to concede, but the snake will not be happy. Far be it from me to question your cunning, father, but in your place I do believe I'd have let Robert Baratheon bloody his own hands. Lord Tywin stared at him as if he'd lost his wits.
You deserve that motley, then. We had come late to Robert's cause. It was necessary to demonstrate our loyalty. When I laid those bodies before the throne, no man could doubt that we had forsaken House Targaryen forever. And Robert's relief was palpable. As stupid as he was, even he knew that Rhaegar's children had to die if his throne was ever to be secure. Yet he saw himself as a hero. And heroes do not kill children.
His father shrugged.
I grant you, it was done too brutally. Elia need not have been harmed at all. That was sheer folly. By herself, she was nothing.
Then why did the mountain kill her?
Because I did not tell him to spare her. I doubt I mentioned her at all. I had more pressing concerns. Ned Stark's van was rushing south from the Trident, and I feared it might come to swords between us. And it was in Aerys to murder Jaime, with no more cause than spite. That was the thing I feared most, that, and what Jaime himself might do.
He closed a fist.
Nor did I yet grasp what I had in Gregor Clegane. Only that he was huge and terrible in battle. The rape. Even you will not accuse me of giving that command, I would hope. Sir Aemry was almost as bestial with Rhaenys. I asked him afterwards why it had required 100 thrusts to kill a girl of 2, 3. He said she'd kicked him and would not stop screaming. If Lorch had half the witch the guards gave a turnip, he would have calmed her with a few sweet words and used a soft silk pillow. His mother